Hello everyone, this is Alexander Metters of GalacticConnection.com, and today is October 21st, 2014. Now, what I'm going to be doing today is presenting you with part two, a continuation from Taking a Walk on the Wild Side with Rupert Harris. And for many of you, you may not know of him. He is based out of South Africa and has been studying arachnology from actually his teens, and has now developed a very interesting and successful business called Amberfelt Safaris and Tours. So when I met him, I was just blown away by his knowledge about nature, wildlife, insects, etc., and its spiritual connection. So I think you will really enjoy part two. We're going to be diving into the Big Five and some of his exciting experiences while on tour, and what exactly his tours consist of, and just the ambiance of what you will experience here in South Africa. For part one, you would just go to the BBS Radio tab on GalacticConnection.com, and you will find part one dated October 21st, 2014. So here we go. Let's get started.
Okay. So, welcome back, Rupert. Thanks so much for coming back for part
two. Thank you.
And how are you doing today?
Very well, thanks.
Good.
Not bad.
Good.
Lovely weather out there.
It is, isn't it?
Yes.
And just for everybody to know, today is October 21st, and we are now just continuing on in part two of Rupert Harris, who is sharing with us an immense amount of knowledge and wisdom about the nature kingdom and the spiders and butterflies and insects and the forests. And now we're going to get into some near and dear information for me, which is the Big Five, as everybody always thinks of. What do you think of when you think of Africa? You think of lions. And one of the things I learned from Rupert is, what is the king of the jungle?
Well,
a hippopotamus, right?
Yes, yes, basically. Well, the thing is that you just got to look at things in perspective, and I suppose the lion is probably the apex predator. Well, is the apex predator, which it shares with the spotted hyena. But in terms of the actual king of the animals, well, I would rather say it would be the African elephant, just given their size and just given their incredible intelligence and how organized they are as animals and how social they are. Even though lions are also social, but just purely if you just look at their how majestic they actually are, I'd say probably the elephant.
You know, it's my favorite animal on the planet.
Yes.
I have such a thing about elephants, and you told me a story the other day. Can you talk a little bit about their tear ducts?
Yes, well, they have these tear ducts that are situated behind the eye, between the ear and the eye, and it's actually essentially like our tear ducts. It's just that it's on a separate channel. And these usually indicate the animal's emotional state, pretty much like ours. But it's also governed by pheromones, hormones. In the case of males that are in musk, which is actually a heightened testosterone, you'll often see these tear ducts actually, basically the tears running down from these ducts. And maybe I should relate the story. There was an elephant whisperer. It's a person that actually has captive elephants, but they're not really captive in the sense that they are putting boxes or cages. Not far off from Polokwane, where I live, an old ex-Rhodesian guy, and he would have people come and have interactions with these elephants, and you could actually ride the elephant afterwards. And he told me about a story once of a an old man and a woman that arrived for an interaction. And when this old man touched the elephant, the tear duct started running. And he completed the whole process of you know, the whole interaction. And then afterwards, the wife of this man came up to the elephant whisperer and actually thanked him for the interaction and told him that this man had actually terminal cancer. And just merely by the elephant touching this man, did the elephant's tear ducts start running. So this elephant knew, intuitively knew what the situation with this man, and just knew possibly his destiny. And of course, this man was very, very close to, you know, the end, so to say. But the mere fact that this elephant actually could pick up on it, it just goes to show that they're, what is the right word? Sentient, is that correct?
Yeah.
I always get mixed up with sentient and sentinel.
Yeah, sentinel, right.
Is, the guardian, right?
Right.
So sentient. They certainly are sentient animals. And you can sense it when you're in Kruger Park and you look at their interactions. You can sense it. There's definitely a lot more to them. They really, really are highly intelligent, highly sentient animals. Just their whole modus operandi.
Now, you do consider them one of the big five.
Yeah, no, they most definitely are.
Okay. Now, what are the other four?
You've got lion. African lion, of course, African leopard, which is about half to two-thirds the size of a lion. Very beautiful animal, something like your, it looks a bit like your jaguar in South America,
okay.
But it's smaller than the jaguar. And then rhino, and there's black rhino and white rhino, but they're both considered the big five. And buffalo. What we call African buffalo. Let me just see. Did I leave one out?
No, I think you did. You got them all five. Now, when you say buffalo, you're talking about the water buffalo, right?
Oh, yes, water buffalo. We actually call them the Cape buffalo, but the association with water is true because they're usually quite close to water because of their digestive system.
Wow. So tell me a little bit about how do the water buffalo interact with one another? Do they work in a similar type of community like the elephants do?
Yes, they do. They're also social animals. They have these massively extended breeding herds that can be in excess of 300 individuals. And it's usually organized where the bulls, the really hardcore bulls that are really powerful, would be on the outskirts, and the cows and the youngsters would be organized sort of in the central part. And they are grazers, so they would then be moving around where there is suitable grass, and they, of course, would be migrating to where there would be grass, but also in conjunction, as I said earlier on, with water. So they're usually not that far off from water, simply because they are ruminants and they cud chewers, and they just need that extra water for that proper digestive system.
Obviously. So are they herbivores
very much herbivores, but they're grazers, which means that they will only be eating grass. They're certainly not browsers. Mm-hmm. Browsers being feeding off leaves of trees.
Mm, okay. And so are they hanging with their woman kind of thing?
Yes, very much so. In the case of elephants, you'll have breeding herds led by a matriarch, and the males would be separate, and you'd have smaller bachelor herds of male elephants hanging out together. And then, of course, with breeding herds, it would be females with young males and, calves, and less experienced females hanging out with the matriarch. But in the case of buffalo, you would have the males and the females hanging out, with the males being on the outskirts. And every now and then you get buffalo bachelor herds, and they're usually older males that can't keep up with the rest and are usually kind of they form smaller groups because of safeties and numbers. And they're usually a lot more aggressive.
Do they have like a major migration pattern, or do they just pretty much hang out along the edge of the river?
No, I think they pretty much just hang out on the edge of the water. Yeah.
Okay.
So it's really just about the availability of food, because they constantly have to eat. It's a huge animal, a buffalo.
Yeah, they're gigantic. And their horns were fascinating because it's kind of twisted, right?
That's right. And you can see from the size of the male's horns that they usually a lot bigger. And, of course, the animal itself is bigger and bulkier. But usually the section, the broadness of the horns in front, just above the head where the horns actually emanate from, that the broadness of those horns is usually a lot more pronounced than with the females.
And are they relatively safe, Rupert? Are they?
Well, they're very targeted by lions, because remember, lions are lions are gregarious, so they also stick together. And when they hunt for the pride. So to floor down a buffalo is a score for them, or it's good eating for them. So they would prefer, they had a choice to try and opportunistically hunt down a buffalo. So there's usually when there's a breeding herd, there's usually some lion following the buffalo for opportunistic reasons. Yes.
Very interesting. And now, are they an endangered species at all?
No. Okay. However, buffalo, and that's a big dilemma in Kruger Park at the moment, buffalo are disease carriers.
Mm.
And they carry a disease that's very significant called bovine tuberculosis.
Mm.
And bovine tuberculosis has actually, if you want to call it, jumped the species barrier now, and it affects lions. And these lions actually get AIDS-like symptoms. They die from AIDS-like symptoms of this disease. So buffalo are, put it this way, buffalo are harborers of disease. And although there are lots of buffalo, disease-free buffalo are very scarce.
Wow, that's a shame. And now I'm having just a huge aha, because I work in quantum homeopathy, and one of the main algorithmic codes that we run across for people is bovine TB.
Yes.
So it's not just the animals, people, which shows me once again, where are these coming from?
Yes. I can't imagine, for example, that 2,000 years ago, for example, or before there was colonialism in South Africa, that there was bovine tuberculosis affecting lions.
Mm-hmm.
So there's something funny going on. I don't know. I can't put my finger on it, but
genetic mutation stuff, too.
Strange stuff. Yes, absolutely.
So tell us a little bit more about the lions.
Yeah, well, they are very territorial. The males are the king, it's a patriarchal society, and they are very, very involved. The males are very involved at protecting their territory and ensuring that there are no intruder males basically getting into their territory to attempt to pass their genes on to the pride, basically to the females. And males usually are solitary, or they form these bachelor coalitions of two males that then would be both passing on their genes, or be mating with the females to pass on their genes. But every now and then they get challenged. And it's quite a horrific story when that happens, because the new male that ousts the existing dominant male, or coalition of two males, would then come in and kill out all the cubs of the previous male and then just start the whole process again. And that, in a way, is actually as harsh as what it sounds, is actually strengthening the gene pool of that particular pride. Yeah, because it's the superior male that now has its right to impose its genetics onto the females. And all I can say is it's a pretty harsh world out there.
Yeah, no kidding. Now, do they mate for life?
No, not well. Put it this way: as long as there's a territory and there are females in that territory, you could say that dominant male, as long as he can hold his territory, is then you could say mated for life to the females that are within his territory. Yes.
And so tell us a little bit about what is the state of the population of lions at this point.
Well, the lions are doing quite well certainly in Kruger Park. And, of course, that's the mainstay park, I would say, certainly in southern Africa. But if you look at southern Africa in general, I would say the lion population for example, Namibia in Natosha and certainly in Botswana is pretty healthy. They just, of course, have this threat now with this bovine tuberculosis, I would say, that would be the main threat that's diminishing some of the population. But I'm not, to my knowledge, has it got to a point where it's as bad as, say, nearly as bad as the cheetah population. The cheetah population is in absolute dire straits.
Oh.
So I think the lion population is fine at the moment. And certainly, if I think to my knowledge, there's something like 3,000 or 4,000 lion in Kruger Park alone. Bearing in mind that there's in the case of mammals, there's a much higher prey-to-predator ratio, which determines a healthy mammal prey-to-predator ratio, yeah.
Now, other than another male, who is the lion's predator?
Yes. Well, yes, that process, I guess, is just a spontaneous a series of events that actually happen. Which doesn't really impact as such,
right?
The threat of the lion population. It's in fact, on the contrary, it's actually a process of strengthening the gene pool because a stronger, more dominant male that can defeat the existing territory holder is in fact what he's actually doing is he's introducing new genes into the population.
That's so fascinating. But what I was also asking was, who is the lion's predator?
Oh, okay. Well, hyenas, I would say.
That's what I was thinking.
Because a spotted hyena is also constantly competing. They've also got a social system, very complex social system, and it's matriarchal. But they are constantly competing with a lion. And although the lion is a more powerful animal, hyenas are very opportunistic. But they're both actually opportunistic on each other's cubs.
Ooh.
In the sense that I think just purely because it's competition, if they do come across cubs, hyenas will, if they're unprotected for whatever reason, hyenas will very opportunistically just simply do away with the competition, but also eat them. Food. It's basically food. So hyenas will eat anything, basically, pretty much like leopards.
Aren't they really aggressive? Like, I was hearing from Chris that that's probably the most feared animal.
Well, I would say, you know, I've often found that, you know, you can, a hyena will probably run away from a human.
Okay.
Yes, but there's been a lot of misconceptions with regards to hyenas, you know, predatory habits and its scavenging habits. And it's always thought that the hyena is just the scavenger. It waits for the lion to actually run down prey, kill prey, and then it will well, steal the prey from the lion, which we call a cryptoparasite. But that's not the case. They found that it's both, in fact. And in fact, that lions are also cryptoparasites. They steal prey from hyenas. But hyenas are incredible hunters, and they're very, very organized. And they've got much greater endurance, than lions. They can sustain 50, 45, 50 kilometers per hour for something like 7 or 8 kilometers, and eventually tire down their prey. And they, as terrible as what this sounds, they literally rip their prey apart in flight. And they found that that's actually a much more humane way for the prey to die compared to the way that lions actually strangle their prey. There's been some studies to prove that they are, in that respect, much more efficient hunters. So, yes, there's certainly a lot of truth in what Chris actually says, but it's, of course, one has to just sort of define it.
Right.
One has to analyze it.
And so do they also... travel, you know, do they have territories, and do they hang
yes.
out like in a community environment as well?
Yes. Yes, they definitely have territories. And what's interesting about hyenas is that the matriarchal female has a hormone level that is 7 times higher than any of the male hyenas. And you can just see she looks about 2 or 3 times the size of them, and she's just this massive, incredibly powerful animal. And she actually does marking of territories, and she actually does basically what the male lions do. So they have definitely marked territories that they mark out, and they usually have a den, and they also have an alpha male and female breeding system. So they are sort of, in many respects, semi-social, similar to bees.
Oh, it just fascinates me. Now, the majority of the animals that you've covered so far,
yes.
they still all pretty much hang out in groups. Now, that I would imagine that's because it's far safer, right?
Yes, it's safer, but it's also a lot more efficient to hunt large prey. If you're one large predator, pretty much like comparing it to driver ants in the Amazon. One ant is pretty vicious, but how about 1 million ants? That's just one huge, big, massive, powerful organism. So it's that same effect.
Our numbers, right?
Yes, basically numbers. So it is safety, but it's also just pushing up the efficiency as well.
So do the hyena and the lion and the cheetah and the water buffalo, it's basically who we've covered so far, are
yes.
they pretty much living in the same type of, you know, like you mentioned, like the savanna versus
yes.
the bush? Are
yeah,
they pretty much all living in the same area?
They share the same space, yes, and they're constantly competing with each other. And you often there's an amazing video to watch called Eternal Enemies, and it's about the relationship and the interaction between lions and hyenas.
Mm.
And I remember that that movie actually, or that video ending, where a male patriarchal lion actually runs down and kills a matriarchal hyena because there was too much of a there were just too many numbers, or there was too little food, because it's really about food, I think, and it's also, of course, space, but it really revolves around availability of food, where the balances were, there were just, for whatever reason, too many hyenas in that particular lion's space. So something has to be done about it. And it happens vice versa as well. I've actually seen footage of hyenas ousting lions.
That is just, I mean, isn't that incredible? It's like
this
built-in, you know, safety valve of, oh, hey, wait a minute, you know, the numbers are getting too high. We need to, you know, step up our aggression a little bit more.
Safety valves is a great analogy. That's a wonderful analogy.
Well, okay, so tell us a little bit about the leopard.
Yeah, leopards in comparison to a lion, by the way, the lion and leopard are the same genus, which is, I'm just trying to think now, I'll come back to that. But anyhow, they are the same genus. So essentially speaking, a lion is a savannah leopard that has become social, if you want to call it that. And so leopards are not, they're true lions, but from a genetic point of view, they're true lions, except that they are obviously more cryptically camouflaged and they're very much solitary. So you'll hardly ever see a leopard unless it's breeding season, or there's a female on heat or something, or there's a mother with young. Leopards are absolutely solitary, so they're very, very different from lions in every respect. And they are stealth hunters. Now, what I mean by stealth hunting is that the lions will use some degree of stealth to creep up to their prey, but they'll use collaboration. There'll be a collaboration of lions that will intercept prey. One will chase the prey, the other one will intercept it at some point and surprise it. Whilst leopards would rely entirely on undergrowth and speed and dashing at the last moment to capture their prey. And, of course, camouflage, their color, their coat is very, very amazing in terms of camouflage. They can absolutely disappear into bush. So leopards are very solitary. They're much smaller, but they have apparently, I've read, that they've got a higher power to mass ratio than a lion, so they're a very, very powerful animal.
So now the lions and the lions, the cheetahs, the leopards, they're all feeding on other large prey, right?
Yes, okay. Yes. However, you know, there's no way that a leopard, for example, will try and take on a buffalo, whilst a bunch of lions will certainly, if they're experienced enough, and I've seen that where they specialize in taking on buffalo, they would be able to capture large prey. Leopards simply too small, even though it's more powerful, it's simply too small to do that. So a leopard would more focus on your small antelope, for example, your impala, young kudus, a lot of your smaller antelope that you'd find along riverine forests, etc., because that would also be where you more likely are going to find leopard, simply because there's a lot more, you know, trees and undergrowth for the leopard to hunt in. There's another very important aspect, and that is where a leopard will, especially where there are large predators like hyena and lion, a leopard will, once it's actually made its kill, will drag its prey into a tree to reduce competition.
That is amazing. They can actually carry their prey up the branch, up the tree stump.
Absolutely. And they do it with almost such ease. Hence their power to mass ratio, which I mentioned earlier on. That's one of the reasons why they require that extra strength, is for that purpose.
Incredible. Now, how are the cheetahs and the leopards doing at this point as far as being an endangered species?
Leopards are incredible animals. They, they're something like your, I would say a bit like your mountain lion.
Okay.
And possibly a little bit more like your coyote, but not in terms of numbers, but in terms of this ability to exist quite close to human habitation, simply because they are such stealth hunters and they keep such a low profile, and they're nocturnal hunters as well. Yeah, lion also prefer to hunt at night or at dawn and dusk, but leopards are very, very much more stealth hunters, although there are exceptions. There's some research has been done where they've found leopards to be hunting monkeys during the day. Guess where? In the Sopansberg, where you are.
Oh, wow.
Oh, yes.
Well, thanks, yes. Luther, for passing that information on.
Yeah. By the way, there are probably leopards just up the road from you.
Oh, my great. Well, how aggressive are they towards people? They're very
shy. They keep out of the human, out of the way of humans, even at night if you're walking around. So they're really no threat. Unless they've been cornered or they've been shot at and they're wounded, then it's like one of the most dangerous animals. Yes, I would say that's in fact why they also branded as the Big Five. But I'll get back to that a little later, what was the true original meaning of the Big Five. But leopards are, to come back to the hunting techniques, yes, they would prefer to take on smaller animals, simply because even though they might be capable of flooring a large animal, how are they going to get it up the tree? So it's in their interests to rather catch small animals. And I'll tell you, leopards eat pretty much anything that they can overpower. They're also very well known to hunt down and catch dogs, pretty much like your coyote to a certain degree, and pretty much anything. So they've got a very, very wide range of tastes, and they'll often eat very small animals like rats and flay rats and all kinds of different rats.
And the cheetah? I mean, what kind of shape are they in?
Cheetah are interesting. They are diurnal animals, which means that they're day hunting. And if you look at a cheetah's eyes, you'll see that it's these dark brown eyes, whilst if you look at lions and leopards' eyes, they've got this this kind of yellowish starlight reflecting evolution to them. So cheetahs are actually day hunting animals, and cheetahs are, as with everybody would know, cheetahs are the fastest land animals, mammals, or certainly animals. They can run at about 110 kilometers per hour for very short distances. They don't have endurance, but given their incredible acceleration and their hunting techniques, they don't really need endurance, because they just need to, in a very short space of time, run down their prey. But cheetah would also very much prefer impala-sized, like your deer, I would say, animals. And they are very, very vulnerable to being overpowered or prey being stolen from them by the other predators, including hyena, because cheetahs are not really these very sturdy, powerful animals. They are pretty powerful in their own right, but if you compare the cheetah's profile and the build of a cheetah, it's actually a lot smaller than that of a lion or a leopard, by a long shot.
It's amazing how they are very different than a leopard in many ways.
Absolutely, yes.
So because they are so accelerated in their ability to escape, are they able to get away from the poaching?
Look, in most cases, they can outrun a lion.
Good.
And a leopard. But I've seen some footage of cheetahs that were, that for some other reason, just weren't fast enough, or just made a wrong decision, where the lion would, for no reason in my opinion, the lion would just kill the leopard, the cheetah, because somehow inherently it's a predator, and the lion probably feels, well, this is, you know, you're in my turf now, mm-hmm. and you're competing with me. In fact, this last, I've just done a tour with an American lady, and we were in a reserve adjacent to Kruger Park called Timbavati, and there are no borders between, there are no fences between the two. And the host there was telling me that just a week before, they were enthralled to see this cheetah that was just hanging out in the bush, and it was in long grass, and just suddenly in front of their eyes, this leopard leapt out, grabbed the cheetah, killed it, dragged it up into the tree, and started eating it. So I think they're very, they're very vulnerable. And I think if there are too many other predators, then cheetahs are probably in the last, they suffer the most, even though they are these really fast animals, because they constantly have to be on the lookout for kleptoparasites that steal their prey. I would say this would be probably the main reason why.
It's kind of like what you and I were talking about the other day, where probably I would say one of the biggest days of my life is to be able to walk amongst the animals and know that no one is hunting anyone. There is no survival of the fittest. You know, there is no death.
Well, that is absolutely a topic all on its own, because if you look at any healthy, in inverted commas, healthy ecosystem, and you go right down to the almost the unicellular organisms, and you go right up to the top, there's that process, and that is branded as harmony. And I mean, if that is if you talk in terms of harmonious creation or whatever, then you have to bring that into the equation.
Mm-hmm.
If you think of the process of predation, generally speaking, and if I want to elaborate on that, if you take, for example, insect parasitism, and you get into what goes on there in terms of how, if you talk about a process of degradation and a process of suffering on the part of the host, you maybe even don't want to go that route, and yet that's part of the whole balance, mm-hmm. process of balance. Yeah, so that's a topic all in its own.
Yeah, I know it is. Well, okay, so now we're down to, we've talked about the elephant, which I want to come back to in a few minutes,
yes.
But the one that's really, really important to discuss is the rhinos.
And yes.
I was wondering if you could give everybody just a snapshot of,
yes.
how they live and how they sustain themselves and what's going on with the poaching situation,
yes.
in Africa.
Well, look, generally speaking, a rhino, if I'm not mistaken, specifically the white rhino, is the second largest land mammal, mm. in terms of mass. You know, it's a huge animal. And especially the bull. And they're also territorial. They also live in, they're also gregarious. They live in small groups. They also have this territory that is very, very carefully and very rigidly patrolled by a dominant bull. And they have these dung demarcation posts. They actually middens, and there's a system where the dung, the male deposits his dung on a regular basis, and he also urinates. So he's got a very, very set, very rigid, very well regimental system of looking after his territory. There are two species of rhinos. There's the black rhino and the white rhino, the white rhino being the larger one. The black rhino is a grazer. It's usually solitary. It's a very irritable animal, very aggressive. It feels very insecure because it's alone. Mm. And they're very rare. They're browsers. They eat leaves. I think I mentioned that. I'm not sure. And then the white rhino is actually a grazer. It's got these square lips, and it's the bigger rhino. And there was, I think in the last, I'm just trying to think now, it's in the last, say, 3 or 4 years, there's been close to something like 500 rhino that have been poached in Kruger Park alone. And it's all about supply and demand, and it's got to do, obviously, with this rhino horn and this lust for the rhino horn.
And I want everyone to hear, he said, in the Kruger Park, folks.
Yes, yes. No, that's just, I think, just alone in the Kruger Park. And I'm speaking under corrections. I don't have exactly the figure. In fact, you can Google it and just get the latest figure on how many of these have been poached. And I'll tell you, the thing is that certainly the largest concentration of rhino, specifically white rhino, because that's the more common species, is in Kruger Park. So, and as the rhino numbers on the African continent diminish so that the demand for rhino horn goes up. And it's not only China, it's Vietnam, it's Korea, it's all those Far Eastern countries where this demand actually is. And it's supposedly an aphrodisiac, but I've also heard that it's for healing purposes. It's probably quantum mechanical. It's probably about the power of the mind, where the person, the recipient, takes the rhino horn, believes that it's going to be of benefit to him, maybe as an aphrodisiac or whatever, and it actually does happen. So it probably does, you know, because of the power of the mind, it probably does actually bring about some kind of effect on that person. But, you know, if you bear in mind that rhino horn is actually just keratin, there's no pharmacological effects on other than the fact that it's keratin. It's actually, in many respects, sort of ridiculous.
It's absolutely absurd.
It's actually pathetic.
Yeah, it's pathetic. And it's so funny you're bringing this up, because I was sitting with Chris and Sandy last night, and there was a question on one of these shows about the rhino's horn and what its medicinal effects were. And they were basically stating that the whole aphrodisiac thing is completely, total BS.
They also
said that the other thing that the Asian countries claim it's just so great for is fevers. And I'm thinking, do you know how many other things are out there to bring down a fever? Rather than killing a poor, a rhino just for its horns. And also on top of that, you know, look at what they have to do in order to get the horn from the poor creature. It's a very, very inhumane way to bring these poor animals down to their last breath.
Yes.
And so I was going to ask you, now clarify for everyone, they may not understand why in the Kruger Park is a key ingredient to having this information.
See, the thing is that I really think that the Kruger, well, because there's the highest concentration of rhino in Kruger Park, I think that there's been a lot of emphasis placed on poaching there. And I get the sense, and I've heard, but I can't confirm, and I don't want to say this categorically, but I think that there's also from the government side and from the official side, I think there's an inside job going on there. And there's a collaboration between all kinds of organizations, including what I've heard, the Chinese triad. So there's so much at stake here. I think there's so much money at stake. I think there's just so many negative, dark organizations out there collaborating together to get their hands on this because of the incredibly high demand. If I'm not mistaken, 1 kilogram of rhino horn now is just some ridiculous price. Somebody actually told me this last trip, and I've actually now forgotten. But it runs into tens of thousands of dollars,
to
that effect, yes. So one rhino horn, so flying one rhino horn, bearing in mind that, you know, you get quite a few kilograms out of that horn, is worth absolute millions and millions and millions of dollars, you know. So you can see where it's really, you know, you often talk about the compression of the dark.
Yeah.
Right. Well, this is a absolute 3D example of the compression of the dark.
Yeah.
It's this whole desperate situation
that they created.
And it's all money based. It's all about money. Unfortunately, it's, it revolves around money, and it revolves about around how more expensive the horn has actually become, because I think most rhino throughout Africa have been exterminated. Here and there you'll find the odd reserve where there'll still be rhino. And what I've even heard is that there's some people that actually apply for rhino breeding would once they've actually introduced the rhino into a reserve and they start the breeding program, just a few months down the line, they'll be poaching. And it's as if the application to do for the rhino breeding was actually passed on to some dark official. And in no time, when you hear again this rhino poaching that's happening on that particular property. So I think that it goes so deep. In fact, they discovered a white South African guy living here in Polokwane who has been involved with rhino poaching. I won't name any names, but a friend of mine who knew this guy personally told me that he is so involved and so deep in with the rhino poaching organizations that he himself has actually got a price on his head. So even if he decided to come clean and pull out, he's actually got this price on his head. In fact, his life is at stake. So he's actually got no choice but to involve, because it's so deep in with presidents of African countries and the Chinese triads. It's just one massive big nest like you cannot believe.
God. And so at this point,
yes,
how many do you feel are surviving now?
Well, I'm not really supposed to disclose the exact amount of rhinos for the sake of the protection of the rhinos, but we've got still a reasonably healthy population of rhino in Kruger Park at this stage. And there was talk, and quite strong talk, of actually relocating these rhinos to different locations, secret locations in South Africa.
I think that's a great idea. And
yes,
I also wanted to let you know, we have Wild Animal Park in Southern California, and I remember when they first brought the rhino on board, you know.
Yes.
And they brought in two, and they mated them, and they had an incredibly difficult time getting the rhinos to actually, you know, be able to bring forth a successful birth. And I know that they worked on it, worked on it, worked on it. In fact, the last time I was there, which is quite some time ago, it still wasn't being very successful.
Yes.
So when you pull them out of their environment, that isn't even necessarily the answer to helping the numbers, you know, the significant decline in their numbers as well.
Yes. No, well, if they've got the right kind of habitat, specifically the right kind of grass to feed on and whatever,
right,
then they don't do too badly. Funny enough, and I'm actually inviting you to come out to the Polokwane Game Reserve, because we've got a healthy rhino. I'm not going to mention names, how many, but we've got a healthy population of rhino here that seem to be doing real well with breeding.
Hey, sign me up. So, I'm there. Okay.
Yes. I still got to show you that crystal spot.
Yes, definitely do.
So, yeah. But yes. So they seem to be doing well, yeah.
They didn't show up when we were there, and I would really love to see them. Can you clarify for us exactly what the horn is made of and what it does for the rhino?
Just say again, Fora?
The horn of the rhino.
The horn.
What is it made up of?
It's actually a protein. It's made of a protein called keratin.
Okay.
And it's essentially the same protein that makes up your nails, and I'm told your hair as well. So it's actually not horn in the sense of buffalo horn or cow horn or something like that. And it's actually just something that grows throughout the rhino's, throughout the rhino's life. And these rhino actually use termite mounds to hone the horns and to actually sharpen them, because it's basically their weapon. And the central, the lower core of the horn is in fact still got a nervous system. And of course it's fed by blood vessels. So that part of the horn is actually still basically a pulp, like this inner part of your tooth.
Yeah.
And that's the growth point. And when these rhinos get poached, they cut that whole section out. So the rhino goes through unbelievable trauma, especially if it is still alive. And a lot of these rhinos are actually tranquilized, and they are semi-state of awakeness. Or when they awake, then they get woken up with, you know, in this state. So it's absolutely cruel and horrific what's going on. And I think the important thing to understand there is the intent involved. You know, if you're a predator, and it also comes back to that argument that we had earlier on about predation. And I think, you know, any predator has, when it hunts its prey, there's intent involved. And somehow the intent from an energetic level transfers over to the prey as, well, I'm actually serving a specific purpose. But I think the intent here with removing rhino horn is absolutely dark, very dark. And that makes the whole situation that much that worse, that much more horrific for the poor rhino.
Well, and I keep wondering, when will that day be when we wake up and we recognize that what is injured anywhere in the world is ultimately going to boomerang back and affect us?
Yes. You know,
we're all in this together, and the fact that the animal itself, I mean, I don't, whether it's a dog or a cat or, you know, a water buffalo or a rhino,
yes,
you know, to continue to discount and think of the animal kingdom as beneath us when,
that's right,
when they themselves have so much to teach us. If we just stop and watch and listen and observe, you know,
absolutely,
and honor them.
Yes, yes, no, you're right. You know, just to come back to the relocation of the rhino to different locations. That is certainly probably one of the only measures that we can implement at the moment. But that certainly doesn't guarantee that the insiders involved in it are not still going to be involved in it, and still where rhino poaching is still going to happen. Because, you know, obviously, if you're going to relocate rhino to a new location, there's obviously permits involved in it, right? So if there are permits involved in it, then it means that officials are involved in it, and, well, this is Africa. Dare I say any more?
Yeah, right.
Yeah. So in that respect, it's still questionable as to the future of the rhino.
Well, hey, and for all of you out there who write in to me wanting a purpose, wanting a passion, wanting to figure out what your mission is, you can very readily see there are so many opportunities out there to jump in and protect and do your bit to help the animal and the nature kingdom, because it needs our help.
Yeah.
So, so Rupert, we're getting into the really juicy stuff now.
Yeah.
Which is, tell us, you know, you just got back from an amazing trip, and I think you said you went to Guinea, right?
Yes.
Okay. So can you tell us, just give us a bird's eye view for all of you out there. This is what Rupert does, is he creates amazing tours. There's a 12-day tour, which we're going to talk to you about in a few minutes, but you know, you can see the plethora of knowledge that Rupert has. I mean, he can basically take you anywhere and be able to educate you on what you see and how you interact with the environment around you. So can you give us just kind of a play-by-play as to your last adventure?
Yes, well, what I try to do is, you know, people, to start off with, people that want to come to South Africa have a certain marketing perception. As with any country, I guess if I wanted to go to the States, or I wanted to go to Holland or England or whatever, I would have a certain marketing perception about that particular country. And it's really important that aspects, the main aspects of that marketing perception be implemented or included in a particular tour. For example, what do you associate? What is synonymous with South Africa? Obviously, Big Five. Cape Town. Robben Island, where Mandela was incarcerated.
Madagascar.
Et cetera. So I certainly, when I plan my tours, I bring in the icon experiences of South Africa. But what I feel, and pertaining to my my interests, and pertaining to my inherent what I consider to be really important, is to bring in aspects into the tour which actually would go down as a sense of, well, I've experienced the icon experiences of South Africa, but I've actually done something different that was almost not anticipated, but that would go down as an unforgettable experience. That's sort of the long and the short of it. So what that includes then is to do a cross-section, especially of this province, which I think is really an amazing province, which is Limpopo province, the most northerly province of South Africa, where I would have a Kruger Park experience. There would be a Johannesburg experience. There would also then be a typical cultural experience with an ethnical cultural experience where people would have the opportunity to feel and see how the local tribes of Africa, not only South Africa, but of Africa, would live. And to also combine wilderness separation experiences, but not separation experiences where, you know, you're just left in the dark or whatever. It's more like you're living, you've got your accommodation is rustic, but it's luxurious, but you really feel as if you have separated yourself away from civilization as an experience.
Man, I mean, who on this planet would not want to do that? Seriously.
Yes.
And what I really want to say about you, Rupert, that was very appealing is you have all this knowledge and wisdom about the animal and plant kingdom and the insect kingdom, but yet you're also very spiritual and very much on the same page with me. You're very well read. You're very adept in just, you know, being able to see this through a truly higher consciousness perspective. And I really wanted to kind of put that out there to everybody. So anyway, go ahead. I really want people to hear about this.
All right. Well, just to give you a rundown on the this 12-day experience, what I do is after an experience in Johannesburg, which is just basically the icon experiences that you can attend. In other words, what went on with Johannesburg's history and the whole process of apartheid and all the history that went with apartheid. There's a lot of stuff that Johannesburg has to offer. When you the main part of the tour actually starts here in Polokwane, where we have a an ethnical museum that we go to, which is a really amazing open air museum, which gives you a very good idea of a good introduction to African culture. Once we're done with that, then for those that are capable of doing it, we do a cycle through the local game reserve, which is a 3,200 hectare game reserve. And we do this game reserve tour, and it's by bicycle. And what you really do is you cycle through, essentially like cycling through Kruger Park. It's just that there's only one of the big five there. But it's an amazing game reserve because there are species of animals that you don't get in Kruger Park, and they're also very rare species that you virtually don't see in Kruger Park appearing there. And most of them are kind of habituated to Africa, to bicycles. So you have already a sort of a sense of separation for a while in this park. Really, really nice. Okay, then the next day, we stay over in Polokwane. Then the next day, I take you into the mountains about 60 kilometers away from here and going east. And for those who want to do it, I put you onto a canopy zip tour. And it's actually basically these zip lines from waterfall to waterfall through canopies of forest.
Oh.
Very, very, very amazing. It's known as the Mahuba's Kloof Canopy Tour. And that is a two-hour experience.
Nice.
Right. When we're done there, I take you to the largest baobab tree on the African continent, which has got a 46-meter girth. And it's just one of the most awesome trees on the planet.
It is.
It's not the highest one. It's not as high and it's not as impressive as your sequoia trees. But in terms of its girth and just how amazing it looks and just every aspect of it is really, really an incredible tree. Right, so when we're done there, then we drive up to the western Soutpansberg, which is the Afrikaans word for Saltpan Mountain, which is the mountain that you're in at the moment. And we go up onto Lesheba, which is basically a wilderness area, and we spend 3 days there as a separation experience. And they have rhino, giraffe. They've got virtually all the plains game of Kruger Park. It's just that it's completely separated, and you stay in a vendor village for 3 days. It's an eco lodge, but it's really amazing. Accommodation and amazing cuisine, and it takes at least a 3/4 of an hour to get up this mountain range with a four-wheel drive vehicle. So it really is this separation experience. And there we're going to be doing hikes. We're going to be visiting ancient Bushman painting art. A guide will explain to us what the art's all about. It will be a really incredible separation experience. And we'll be doing hikes. And we'll be discussing insects, butterflies, whatever. Okay. From there, we come down the mountain. That's after 3 days. We come down the mountain. And we spend one night in a lodge, which is focused on Venda African culture. The Venda people being these people related to the Shona people of Zimbabwe, of which Robert Mugabe is a member. They speak a similar language, and that would be a whole, basically a whole experience on Venda culture, which is also representative of a lot of the cultures in South Africa. There are similarities.
They're so lovely, Rupert. I love the Venda.
They are. And optionally, and that's really optionally for those who would like it, I can include a African healer experience. So
Now tell them a little bit about that. That's cool.
Yes, these are shamans, because a lot of the people are actually shamanistic, even though some of them are half Christian, half shamanistic. African shamanism, very similar to the North American shamanism. It's just that the divining process is done with a bag of bones. And what they do is they the person or the medium, what we call the Sangoma, which is the shaman, actually does a reading of your whole life and gives you a rundown of your life. And then thereafter, if you're interested in more, if you've got more questions, whatever your situation is, it can be your health, it can be your finance, it can be your love life, whatever. You can ask as many questions as you like to this shaman, and every time it's a bone throw. And then these bones get interpreted in a specific manner, and advice is given to you. And you can then go further by recommendation of the shaman, you can actually decide to receive some African medicine. And it's usually not pharmacological. It is usually etheric. So you would then receive this medicine, and then you would actually administer it according to a recipe that is given for you. And I've seen that to actually work very, very well. I've actually got a friend who lives in Santa Barbara, who himself, he's a white person, and he's actually a shaman based in Santa Barbara in California, doing it very successfully. So I really think there's a lot of clout to it actually working.
Rupert, are you willing to share with the folks your experience that you had with the shaman?
Am I doing what?
Are you willing to share your experience with one of the shamans who, remember you were telling me the story?
Yes, because my father died in a very early age, I always resisted having my future being told to me. So, but at some point, this friend of mine, his name is David Coombs. I decided to actually have my bones thrown by him, and it was absolutely fascinating. And that was in about 2003, around about there. And what he actually revealed was that my grandmother was, he first of all asked, is my grandmother an artist? I said, no, well, not an artist as in painting or whatever, but she was a concert pianist.
Right.
And he said, well, yes, that's certainly an artist, you know, music is art. So he said, well, your grandmother is above your head the whole time. And I happen to be a musician as well. I'm a jazz pianist. And he said that it was your grandmother, it's your grandmother that's your drive force in your life. And it's true, because I don't really practice piano. Things just happen for me, and I can't explain why they do, but they actually do. From a musical point of view. But then towards the end of the brain throw, I just thought I'd ask a question about my father, and I said, well, how's it going with my father in his realm? And he said, well, let me throw the bones for you again, and he did. He said, well, your father is happy, but he's just lonely in his realm. So I said, oh, okay, that's interesting. Then he said to me, well, would you like to dream about your father tonight? So I said to him sort of skeptically, I said, ah, well, yes, why not? Let's give it a bash.
Little did you know.
So that night he gave me a herb to sniff. I had to burn it, and I just had to sniff in the smoke. And he gave me a little necklace that was made of shells and bones, and he said, put this on. And he said, now go to bed early tonight. Well, I'll tell you what, I had the most unbelievably profound dream, the most vivid, this is the most important thing I can remember about it, the most vivid dream of my father. And it was going back to when I was about 7 years old, and my father being at the dam, and his favorite pastime, of course, was fishing. And he had this hat on, and he looked so happy, and he looked so calm and collected, and he was showing me where the best spots were to fish. And he was just so, not in direct language, but he was just so happy to connect with me. And I cannot imagine for one moment that was just pure coincidence. Wow. You know, it could just be that your mind plays tricks with you or whatever, but the vividness, that's just the important thing that I remember about that dream, was how vivid it was. And I'd virtually never dreamt of my father before that, so I can't account this to being just purely coincidental. I think there's more to it than that. So really what I'm trying to say is that there seems to be a lot more to shamanism, and especially predicting and having your bones thrown, or whichever system is used, than what you can ever imagine.
Yeah, and hey, what what better way to expand your consciousness and experience Africa all in one?
Absolutely. The majority of the people that I've had on one of these sessions have found it rather profound. You know, some people find the information a little bit disturbing. It depends. You know, it depends how you embrace it. And you know, you can you don't necessarily have to interpret everything that is said as true. It could just be that it's a different interpretation of what they might say something about you, and it might just be that the message that they've got is just interpreted in a certain way, which might not be the right interpretation.
Right, right. Well, and you know, it's just like everything else. You take what resonates with you, and you leave the rest behind.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So now, what happens after the shaman?
Yes. So then, right. So then, we've done now with the whole cultural experience. That's usually one night in that vendor area, and then we head out for Kruger Park for 3 days. But en route to Kruger Park, we stop over at an ancient salt collecting site by a group of people known as the Tsonga people, who are originated from Mozambique about 200 years ago. And the site is just basically these interesting filters that are built from natural materials, and it's a whole spiritual process for these women to actually gather the salt. They go through a whole shaman ritual every day before they actually start gathering the salt, so that their ancestors can actually help them to be successful for the salt gathering process that day. And this is a little bit on your way out. So the route between Venda and Kruger Park is there's a diversion of probably something like 30 or 40 kilometers to this venue. And we do a walk out. It's a hike past a spiritual hot spring. There's a whole explanation as to what goes on there in terms of the spiritualism involved. And then there's usually this demonstration of salt by the old ladies that live in the area. And that usually takes up most of the morning. And by that afternoon, we've arrived at one of the gates of Kruger. And then for the next 3 days, we basically spend traversing Kruger and experiencing every aspect of Kruger.
Yeah, and Rupert, do me a favor, because these people don't know much about Kruger Park. I didn't.
Yes.
Can you tell them just a little, just give them a lowdown on Kruger Park, because it's amazing.
Yes, Kruger Park is certainly our flagship national park in South Africa. We've got numerous parks in South Africa, but it's wedged in between the northeastern part of South Africa against Mozambique, the border of Mozambique on the one side, and the top part of Zimbabwe on the other side, or on the most northerly point. It's about 400 kilometers long, and it's about, at its widest point, about 150 kilometers. And it was proclaimed in 1898, and it was prepared, and eventually by about 1923, it was new land was added onto its existing size. So it's been pristine, basically.
Yeah.
It's been a pristine African park, virtually from the turn of the century, and it's hardly interfered with. For example, if there are natural fires there or natural diseases that break out, they just let it be. For example, if there's an outbreak of anthrax that kills a whole lot of elephants, that's just left to be, because that is the natural process. The only time they ever interfere with it is with foot and mouth disease, because it is so contagious. But otherwise, it is left as pristine as possible. So what you experience in Kruger is in its absolute pristine form that it was originally. And that's the beauty of it.
It is. And the fact that you drive through And yes. You know, you're not really allowed to get out of your car in most
That's right.
places because
That's right. You're not allowed to drive. You're not allowed to get out. You do, in fact, to compensate for walking, there are walks that you can do.
Yeah.
The early morning walks that you can do from some of the camps. There's also 5-day, 3 to 5 day trails that you can do with two guides that have actually rifles with them in case. So there are many options available in Kruger. But in the case of my tour, you basically drive from one camp to the other camp. And what I try to do is I try to cover, do a large cross-section, or shall I say a longitudinal section of Kruger, because it's a very elongated park, as to cover as many of the eco zones as possible, and also with the aim of getting to the southern parts, the central and southern parts of Kruger Park, where there's a higher concentration of predators, specifically lion and hyena, but also cheetah.
And you know what? That is worth its weight in gold, is to have someone like yourself who knows exactly where to
yes.
go. Because this park is gigantic.
That's huge.
Doesn't it take, how many days does it take to get one in?
Well, yes, if you really had to spend, if you really wanted to have an all-encompassing experience of Kruger, I would say that you would need at least 5 days. Yes, because, you know, there's just so many different eco zones there. Kruger is very flat. It is not it's not a mountainous. There's one section at the bottom towards the south western side that's quite mountainous, but it's more hilly than mountainous. But for the rest, Kruger is very flat, and it comes across as being just more or less one kind of eco zone, but it's not. It's one of the most biodiverse eco-zone parks in the world. In fact, I think it is just about the most biodiverse, which is quite a surprise if you think of Indonesia and you think of Thailand and all these other places. You would think that that's where the biodiversity would occur. But in terms of actual eco-zones and vegetation zones, Kruger is one of the most amazing on Earth.
That, I did not know that. And,
yes.
And the other question I have for you is, who actually owns Kruger Park? Is it the government?
Yes, it's a national park, yes.
Okay.
It's South African National Parks. It's the flagship park of South African National Parks. So it's actually a government property.
The other
it's actually a park for everybody.
Yeah, it's really cool. And the other thing I just love about it are the accommodations.
Accommodation, yes. It's essentially a three-star experience. And they usually consist of huts, but the huts are very well appointed. It's, as I said, three-star accommodation. You've got all the basic things that you need. You've got an ensuite bathroom. You've got air conditioning, which I would say in summer is essential because it gets incredibly hot in summer. And then you have very well appointed restaurants, and you've got an amazing little shops that have got. That cater for most of your needs and cater for self-catering. Self-catering means if you want to cook for yourself. So there's just a whole lot of different options that they provide.
The last one that we stayed in was my favorite, where you walked into a central room and it was it was circular.
Yes.
And then you walked off onto a balcony that
yes.
overlooked a ravine where, you know, it looks like a river ravine.
Mm.
And it was, the showers were actually outside.
Yes.
Surrounded by, you know, pieces of wood.
Yes.
So you're still kind of having that outdoorsy kind of experience that you
yes.
You're still not totally roughing it.
That's right. Yes. It's sort of to add to the ambiance of the African experience. So, it's I guess these are all, and of course it varies from camp to camp where you would have that kind of experience. Some of them would be internal showers, some of them would be outside. Depends on what experience you would want.
Right.
Yes.
So now after you've gone through the Kruger Park with your assistance after 3 days, then what?
Right. Adjacent to adjacent to Kruger, essentially wedged onto Kruger, are these private game reserves. And one of the private game reserves that I take my people to is called Timbavati, and it's famous for its white lions. It's the only spot in the world where these white lions occur, which is just a genetic variation of a normal lion. It's just that the lion itself is sort of cream-colored to a very white cream color. As I said, that's the only place where they occur. But there's no real difference other than the fact that they've got this different coloration. But these private game reserves have lodges that are pretty upmarket, so it would be for the high enders to go to. But there's also in between different experiences. But what I do is I take people to, depending on the availability of accommodation, take them to a lodge where part of the service, the lodge of course is being very fancy, but what part of the service there would be these amazing, amazing game drives. And what happens is that you go on a Land Rover or a four-wheel drive vehicle, and in collaboration with other people going on tours, you have trackers on these vehicles, and there you are absolutely guaranteed to come close up to the Big Five. I'm talking like within meters of the Big Five.
Wow.
So you'd, for example, like in my tour that I did in March, for example, we were right up against the leopard where I could actually hear the leopard busy stripping the bones of this impala. And we could even smell. The smell was right there. And there's very little chance of you having that experience in Kruger, given the fact that leopards are so elusive. But yeah, you have a number of vehicles on one game drive, and you've got a number of trackers all in radio contact, so they collaborate with each other. But they also have this protocol where there's not an overcrowding of people at a particular Big Five sighting.
Sure.
So it's done very tastefully, and it also involves off-road driving to get to these animals, which is not allowed in Kruger. So it's a very different experience, and it's absolutely the flagship experience of this tour.
That sounds like a blast.
Yes. So it's a combination of the Kruger Park, which is really nice and very pristine, and with this huge variety of habitats, combined with this experience, which guarantees, for whatever reason, if you haven't seen, say, for example, a lion or whatever, now you're definitely going to see it. It's almost a guarantee. But it's done. It's done with. It's also a pristine environment. So these animals are free. In fact, there's no border fence between Timbavati and Kruger Park. So these animals move in and out. They migrate. But most of them are resident animals, and they habituated to these vehicles. So they just carry on with their business. And because it gets done on a regular basis, they, if you want to call it, allow these vehicles to come right up to them. So you would be 5 meters away from a leopard busy stripping an impala.
Wow.
Or you'd be 10 meters away from a lion that had just made a buffalo kill.
Wow, that's amazing. Now, do me a favor too, clarify.
Yes.
For someone like myself coming from the States, when I hear it's a game park, I'm immediately thinking, oh, they're just having all these animals, you know, shipped in so that they can bring in these really wealthy people.
Yes.
And they can shine a big light on them, you know, say, oh, wow, I hunted it, and take home a trophy. You know,
yes.
Is there a difference between one game park versus another?
Well, you know, I've scrutinized a lot of these parks, at least these private game reserves. And I have selected the parks, the game reserves, where the authenticity is maintained. So I, for example, know that Timbavati, as an example, is the real deal. The only difference with Timbavati and Kruger is that the Timbavati animals, even though they're wild, they've just got used to the, if you want to call it, this Land Rover format that gets to them, that doesn't interfere with what they're doing, and they've got used to this, so they don't actually run away from the Land Rover as a unit. For example, if you're on that Land Rover, one of the things that they're very emphatic about is that you may not stand up, because then it confuses the animal. So these animals have got habituated to that, so they carry on with their life. Everything is absolutely pristine, much the same way as Kruger. It's just that they have, because it's a private game reserve and their policies are different, they then allow you, they allow these Land Rovers or these gamers, game vehicles, to come right up to these animals. And I think the combination of Kruger with that is actually really exciting.
Oh, I bet. I bet. Well, oh my gosh, I can't even believe what you're offering. Is there more?
Well, yes, we're going to get to, we're getting towards the end of the trip now, but yes, we'll get to that. But so, you know, I'll just give you an example. This last trip, that I did about 3 weeks ago, we didn't come across a leopard kill, but we were right up against a big, aggressive male leopard. And we were literally driving right next to it. And it was literally 5 meters from it. And soon after that, we left that and we went straight out to a hyena den. And there was a matriarch hyena busy feeding five little hyenas of different ages. And, you know, to experience that in Kruger is not impossible, but here it's absolutely guaranteed that you'll see something like that. It was just amazing. And two years ago, we were right up against a lion that had just, two lion, male lions that had just made a buffalo kill. And they were busy actually disemboweling the buffalo.
I don't know if I'd want to see that.
I know. It's not everybody's cup of tea. But, I mean, but that's just how, and I'm talking about literally being 15 meters away from that scenario.
Well, and you're completely embedded in the wild.
Yes, yes.
That's amazing.
And I've got to mention this as well. In most cases, you stay in the park, at least the lodge that you stay in hasn't got any fences. So you need to be escorted from, for example, the dining room to your hut. Unlike in Kruger, which is fenced off, yeah, you actually need to be fenced in because you might walk into a lion. Which adds to the excitement.
Yeah, big time. So it's a total adventure.
Yes.
I'm sure there's not some sort of waiver that could really cover the potentiality.
Yes, absolutely. Well, when you go into one of these, when you sign a, when you arrive, you have to sign a waiver in any case. So. But, you know, as long as you just follow the protocols, then it's fine. And there's never really been that, you know, major incidences.
So it's
really fine.
I would say the majority of my audience, you know, they're guardians, they're fearless. They're the light warriors. They're going to be like, bring it on!
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's fantastic. You can even do day walks there if you request it. So there are a number of different possibilities. No, absolutely. That's a really, really amazing experience.
And so you just put this whole thing together. It became so natural for you, especially because of growing up with your father and learning, you know, so much about the plant, animal, insect kingdom.
Yes.
Such a natural thing for you. I mean.
Yes. No. Absolutely. I just think that the combination of the different venues and the different experiences, they all blend in, and it's a very good cross section of it's a very good South African cross section experience. Yeah.
Well, and really giving a full flavored taste of Africa that we sense and think it to be.
That's right. You know? Yes. Absolutely.
Rather than focusing on all the, you know, unfortunately, there's so much of the world that only hears the tragedies.
That's right.
And they don't really get exposed to the beauties and the incredible things that are going on here. Which leads me to my next question is, tell me about the assertive groups that are working very diligently to protect all these animals, plants, species, etc.
Well, you know, generally speaking, I think if you compare South Africa's conservation policies to the rest of Africa, I think this is probably the most diligently protected country as a whole. Look, our government Department of Conservation is fortunately quite well run, I think. Except, of course, the rhino thing. I think there's just so much money at stake there that that's been compromised. So I don't think there's much that one can do to halt that at the moment, just simply because there's, you know, because it's just so much at stake.
Right.
There are different private companies. There's non-governmental organizations that all contribute. Each of the nine provinces seem to be more dynamic than the others. For example, the KwaZulu-Natal province, which is our most northerly coastal province, their policies there are more rigidly protected. And there are different companies that are involved as well. Unfortunately, I can't give you all the names, but they there's also so much at stake there, for example, with regards to the turtles and very sensitive dune forests and all kinds. And, you know, that's just another, by the way, that's just another aspect of South Africa that I haven't even touched on. That is also amazing. That can also be combined with this. I think, yes, it's mainly, I would say it's mainly the government conservation departments that are playing the major roles in this process. I know a few certainly now of the, you know, where the rhinos are involved, you know, specifically with the rhino dilemma, or shall I say crisis, where more money is being invested to try and curb the whole process. I can't name them offhand, but there's certainly a handful that are contributing quite considerably.
Awesome. Good. It's nice to hear that, because we just don't get enough of that the other side of the world, you know, getting the balance and the perspective that there is a lot of conservation going on.
Yes.
So, before we tie up the interview, I really would like you to answer a couple of questions, and that is, I know you've gone on some pretty crazy trips, and what would you consider to be one of your more shocking experiences on one of these trips?
You mean in my life?
Yeah.
When I was 23, I met a crazy guy that said no, he'd like to hitchhike through Botswana. And I just confided in him, and I thought, well, okay, you've got the plan, let's just go along. And of course, I was quite adventurous. And we took a military plane right up to the Angola-South African border, at least Namibian border. And from there, we started hitchhiking into Botswana, and we ended up in Moremi Game Reserve, which is on the one border of the Okavango swamps. And this guy said, no, he wants to hug the Kwai River, right, which is this little border river on the edge of the swamp. And he said, no, it's going to be good. You know, it's going to be nice nature and whatever. Well, let me tell you, it was, in fact, Big Five terrain.
Oh, my God.
And I had a backpack, and I had a hammock, and we had, and we were basically just walking. And it's literally like walking through Kruger Park. Yeah, we came across elephant, lion, and I had a knife. That's all I had.
Oh, my God. How about him?
And I had nothing, I just had a knife, basically, just a smallish, well, a medium-sized knife. And we slept in hammocks in trees. And that first night, I remember he had a bottle of Baileys. You know Baileys?
Yeah.
Okay, he had a bottle of Baileys. And we put the hammock up in the tree. And that night, we never slept. We sat in the top of the tree drinking Baileys.
I bet.
Because below us was a hippo. Now, let me tell you, a hippo is the most dangerous African animal, without a doubt. They are a hippo's got something like 5 tons of biting power. And they're very territorial, and they feel very nervous. They come out to graze at night, and once they're out of the water and you encounter a hippo, there's a good chance that you're going to be chased. And, of course, if it catches you, it's just going to bite you. And also, if you're in the water and there's a hippo in the water, they just feel, for some reason, encroached upon.
Yeah.
And this thing was around the fire that whole night, and we were just too scared to get down to the fire.
Oh, my God.
And, I will just in my life never forget that walk.
That's crazy. And actually, if you think about it, just going through that experience really paved the way for you to be so fearless like you are now.
And it was for about 7 days, eh?
Oh, my God.
Yeah. We came across Cape wild hunting dogs. We came across 300 herd of 300 buffalo.
Oh, my God.
We came across elephants. It was just unbelievable, you know. I'll never forget this friend of mine, Chris. He wakes me up one night. We are sleeping, and he says, "Climb higher into the tree." I said, "Why?" And as I start climbing higher into the tree, a tree not far off from us suddenly crashes down. It was this elephant pushing down trees at 12 o'clock at night.
Whoa!
So, yeah. Well, I tell you, I've done diving in Comoro Islands, and I was in the Amazon in 2003.
Wow.
In basically Guyana, and I've also been through Angola in 1996, where I was under the stars for 40 nights of my life. But let me tell you, that experience in Botswana, walking there amongst the Big Five, if I'd known what I'd letting myself in for there, I would have never have done it. Never. It was just actually, I'm actually not even boasting about it. I think it was pretty stupid.
Yeah, right. Especially if you only had a knife.
Yeah, of course. But somehow we survived. It was amazing.
Well, you were protected. And, you were protected so you could bring all your knowledge forth to everybody else.
Yes. That was incredible.
So what would you consider to be one of your most profound, like, spiritual breakthroughs?
Well, I would say I've hiked the Fish River Canyon, which is the second largest canyon on Earth, in Namibia in 1989. And I would say just being in the base of that canyon at night with the stars, and next to the fire with those canyon walls on the side and the moon coming up and just hearing that water pass by you, the Fish River, I think that was probably the most profound experiences. I can't describe the energy of that place. I mean, it's not nearly on the scale of the Grand Canyon, but it is the second largest canyon on Earth. And I would say that's probably close to being the most spiritual experience, just in terms of the awesomeness of that canyon and just that experience down there. In fact, I wouldn't mind doing that in my life again.
Wow. And so what do you feel people ultimately walk away with when they're changed by going on their tours? You know, what do you think the ultimate common thread?
Well, I think a balance of appreciation. Mm-hmm. I would say a balance of appreciation. So, it's The aim of the tour is sort of an awakening awareness process of moving away from being mind programmed just by marketing perception,
yeah,
into a mode of seeing what else this world has got to offer for you, but also in the right environment where that is where it can happen, where it's conducive to that. So I think the aim, the hope is that people actually really feel that they get a an unforgettable, balanced experience of what Mother Earth has to offer.
Yeah, and close-up experiences.
Close-up experiences, and also something that would initiate, I guess you want to say it that way, would initiate a perpetuation process. So people would want to do that over and over. So it would be like a almost like a little training course, in the sense that, wow, that was so profound. Let me see if I can start where in my immediate environment to start realizing what there actually is, you know.
Rupert, you know, you just have no idea what you're offering to the world. I mean, truly, this is such a diamond, such a gift.
And oh, thank you.
I have been so honored to meet you. Do you keep the number of people in the tour guide? Do you keep them to a minimum?
Yes, I don't like working with large groups. I feel that a group of about six max would be great, because I can interact and then I can forward my energy. Because you see, I try to forward my energy to people.
Yeah.
So it's not more. I try to move away from a dictatorship, and I try to move away from a typical sort of stereotyped tour scenario. So. And I also try to move away from giving people basically like a tick-off list type tour where, I've been to Kruger. All right, tick-off, you know. I've been to Robben Island. Now I can go back to my friends and say, oh, well, I've been to Robben Island. I can feel good about myself. So what I feel is that they can still have that experience, but they can come back with something that they can really say was profound.
Yeah.
And life-changing in the sense that they are now going to hopefully be aware of the immediate environment in a different way.
Right, and it leaves an indelible mark.
Yes, a value-changing mark, I would say.
And
that's my intention.
I would say the majority of the people that probably come away from your tours, they probably are really challenged to start going in a different direction if they're stuck, you know.
Yes,
because
yes.
It really kind of opens their eyes to the sense of freedom and interaction and the beauty of just
yes.
living with nature.
Absolutely.
Well,
yeah.
Is there anything that you would like to share with the audience as far as what can they do to help the animal kingdom and the nature kingdom? Is there anything that you would suggest they do?
Well, I think what I'd like to do, I don't have that information with me right now. But I think immediately, if I can think of something, that would be the rhinos. And there are organizations out there that are really putting a lot of good effort into fighting the poaching that's going on and the crisis. You know, it's a
right.
catastrophe that's happening at the moment. And what I can suggest is that I would like to, if that's possible with you, if I can gather that information together, especially websites, maybe if people want to contribute, whatever, and place it on your, it can be placed on your website.
Yeah.
And it can be, they can contact and make a contribution. I would say that would be the immediate thing, because that really, really at this stage is it's reached absolute catastrophe proportions, and something needs to be done very fast about it. Otherwise, we're not going to have no rhinos left very soon.
And the other thing, too, Rupert, is you would be doing a real service for anybody who's very passionate and hot about conservation of wildlife, because there are several organizations that have come across my desk that if you follow the trail up to the top, you find out that none other than, you know, the world order of some proportion is actually running the show.
Yes.
And yeah. So we really want to make sure that if people really feel compelled to, you know, get involved or donate yes. money, that it goes to the right hand.
Absolutely, yes. I think generally speaking, there's, you know, if you just look at the total sum of our situation at the moment with the world population explosion, and you look at, you know, our exponential world population explosion, and you look how we are using up resources, and you look at what's going on with the decline of species, especially sensitive species.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, that is just so important, especially in South Africa, where we've got lots and lots of endemic species of both plant and animals. I would say yes, by all means. I just need to gather together a number of important, shall I say, priorities in that respect.
Sure.
And then yeah. Once I've got them, and we can put them on your site or...
Well, I'm even thinking we could create a button, you know, just for that purpose.
Like okay.
There's enough interest out there and enough of us that really want to help.
Yes. So sounds amazing.
That would be outstanding. Well, last but not least, and that is talk to me a little bit about the cradle of humanity.
Okay.
Match that in with
yes.
what you do.
Well, if you are talking our conventional science, and of course we know that things change and there's a lot of alternative information out there, but if you look at conventional science and you look at specifically paleoanthropology, then you look at Southern Africa, you could term Southern Africa and the Great Lakes of Africa. In other words, Tanzania, Kenya, around that part of the world, and Uganda. You could term it as the cradle of mankind from a paleoanthropological point of view and from a paleontological point of view, paleontology meaning fossils, because as from the turn of last century, discoveries were made in certain caves and certain mining operations around parts of South Africa. The discoveries were made of really interesting fossils that were of apes that fell in between the brain capacity and the anatomics of a human skull and a gorilla and a chimpanzee skull. So they clearly were not either one of the two, and they were obviously a different species. And they were clearly something that was extinct, suggesting then that there was obviously some ancestry to man, because they clearly were ape-like. And, of course, different parts of the skeletons were also found, and they were found to be, some of them seemed to be upright walkers, some of them seemed to be in between upright walkers and something else. But also there's been evidence that at some point these hominoids went through some development where they would, for example, have started using fire, for example, a species called Homo erectus. But anyhow, most of them go back to around about 3 million years. And there seems to be a sequence of fossils and paleontological evidence suggesting that there was a lineage that were hominoid-like in a in sequence of advancement, starting from a species going right back to about 3 million years ago called Australopithecus africanus. Australopithecus means southern man, Australia as in Australia, right? And a series of species in between, some of them being the most dominant being Australopithecus it's africanus, and then Australopithecus boisei, and then moving into what was known as the hominoids or the homos, which usually refers to upright walkers, being Homo erectus, Homo habilis, Homo ergaster, and then moving into more modern man. And of course then not discounting Neanderthal man, but Neanderthal man seemed to be more focused or seemed to be more prevalent around Europe. And I think the whole Neanderthal thing is in any case very mysterious. But anyhow, so Africa is a prime venue for these fossils. And collectively speaking, we refer to these sites as the Cradle of Man sites, one of the most famous ones being just outside Johannesburg. So if you are in Johannesburg on this tour, it would be one of the my recommendations is to go to what is known as the Sterkfontein site, which is about, what would it say, about 35 kilometers outside Johannesburg, but you can arrange the tour. It's really, really amazing. And they've got an amazing museum there depicting conventional sciences take on our ancestry. But, of course, we now know that there's all kinds of other possibilities. Wow. So, yes. So this is a really other, I would say, exciting aspect of being in South Africa.
And it all ties in so well, doesn't it?
Absolutely. It ties in amazingly well with it. And I mean, the other thing is that, these were fossils, without a doubt. So it's not like they never existed or they were placed there or they were staged there. I mean, there were definitely these different sites where they were actually discovered. And one of them, in fact, is only about 40 kilometers from Polokwane. It can be arranged. It can be a tour that's actually arranged. But I would say the one that gives the most information would be the one just outside Johannesburg called Sterkfontein. And I would most certainly recommend it as part of the African experience, because it really could well be that this is, and I say could well be because I think we're still in a whole path of discovery, could well be the cradle of mankind.
Yeah, I actually think it is, and I'm finding out from a more of a spiritual and etheric positioning that
Yes. This
is definitely where it all began.
Yes, it is.
One of the reasons I'm here, folks, is I have been called again to do some very important spiritual work here. And in fact, I'll have to talk to you later. We're about to take off to go do another mission, which is very exciting.
Wow.
So, Rupert, I can't thank you enough. I so appreciate all your wisdom and knowledge, and just the fact that you're passionate enough to, just to present to people a non-fearful perspective of, some pretty, powerful, rambunctious animals out there. And, just being able to see that through a more balanced perspective. And,
yes.
And so I just really, really thank you for all you do. And
it's a pleasure.
I would love to please share with the audience what your email address is and the name of your touring company again.
Okay. I call myself Amber Felt Safaris and Tours. And my email address is amberfelt@access.co.za.
And you may want to spell that because...
Yes. Yeah. Amberfelt is spelled AmberVeld. And access is spelled AXXESS.co.za.
Perfect. So please, everyone, if you're interested in coming out here, you know, you'd be surprised what kind of airplane flight deals you can get out this way. This is a life-changing experience, and I really do feel that Africa needs our love, it needs our attention, and it definitely needs our spiritual pouring of the light from our hearts and our souls, seriously. So anyway, thank you, Rupert, and I want to thank everybody for just hanging in there, being patient with me. I'm still in South Africa, but I'm still working behind the scenes. And if you have any questions regarding the implant removal process, feel free to drop us a line. There's so much information up on the blog about the details. And I think we're up to, I think we're up to like 6 interviews detailing all the different types of questions and answers that have come up. And other than that, I wish you all a very wonderful rest of the week. I love you all. You are awesome. And you all take care. Have a wonderful rest of the day. Thanks, Rupert.
It's a pleasure. Thank you very much.
You're welcome very much. Bye, everyone. Thanks, Alex.